This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor. Welcome to the CapEx podcast from the Margaret Thatcher Conference on Security. I'm here with Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi, an international religious leader, philosopher, award-winning author, and respected moral voice, according to his own website.
Well, I couldn't possibly disagree with that, could I? But it's very kind of you, and good to be here, and part of a very important conversation.
So the panel you've just been speaking on, it was about Western values and what they mean. And I was struck by something you said, which is that you felt that in America, the American story had broken down, that if you read books like by people like Charles Murray or Robert Putnam, you know, that half the population aren't really buying into the story that's been told them about if you work hard, if you succeed, you can get on and have a good life. I mean, would you say that the same applies here in Britain?
Well, it's particularly striking in the States because of how the country began. It began with Puritans. It began essentially with Calvinists who were leaving Europe in search of religious freedom. And they were very, very entrenched they lived with the biblical story, essentially a story of exodus and escape from tyranny to freedom, and it became the American story. So American identity had a great deal to do with telling a story. I'm not sure the British identity was constructed on quite those lines. And that story had enormous power because it meant that the Irish and the Italians and the Jews and all the subsequent waves of immigrants were inducted into that story. It was told to them at school, it was inscribed in the great monuments. I pointed out once that if you go to Washington and look at the Lincoln Memorial or the Jefferson Memorial or the Martin Luther King Memorial, they have screeds of text. In the case of Lincoln, the second inaugural and the Gettysburg Address, Martin Luther King, more than a dozen quotes from his speeches, whereas if you go to Parliament Square and look at the British monuments, you will see that David Lloyd George gets 3 words, David Lloyd and George. Nelson Mandela gets 2, Churchill gets only 1. So in America, monuments are things you read rather than in Britain. So,
And of course, the Vietnam War Memorial would be another...
Absolutely. And so there was an American story. So when I read in 2012 Charles Murray's book Coming Apart, in 2015 Robert Putnam's book Our Kids, saying that for a good half of America, that dream was no longer there. And that dream said equality of opportunity, we all created equal, and therefore by hard work and determination, there is nothing we cannot achieve personally and for our families. When half of America could no longer relate to that, that was serious, because the most obvious thing that hits you in America is how rapidly everyone buys into that story. You know, the taxi drivers in America may speak in very broken English, but they surely to goodness know the American story. So when I read that in America, I realized that was a problem, given the context and content of American political culture. In Britain, we don't have a story. We don't have a constitution. We don't have, you know, Peter Hennessy once said that the British constitution is whatever the cabinet secretary and the Queen's secretary jot on the back of an envelope. So in England, a great teacher of mine, Roger Scruton, wrote a book called England, an Elegy, in which he said England is a home, and in a home things are there because they're there. So I realized that England has a slightly different approach to these things. And I sat and discussed that a lot with two prime ministers in particular who were concerned about it. That was John Major and Gordon Brown. Both of them wanted to know how to give expression to what makes England, England.
Now, and Britain, Britain.
And Britain, Britain. And John Major was struck by those great speeches made in, I think, 1931 by Baldwin, you know, those very evocative things about an English landscape and the things that made England feel like home. And he did a speech along those lines, very Baldwin-esque, about nuns cycling through the mist.
Yes, although by coincidence, David Willetts, who we had as our guest on this podcast recently, was talking about how that was an echo of Orwell, who was trying to explain how you can disagree with the politics of a country, but still love it.
Yeah, yeah. Orwell, in the 40s, wrote that kind of essay. It was Baldwin who John Major was thinking about. But yes, Orwell wrote something very similar. With Gordon Brown, and of course, people made fun of it, because in England, laughing at yourself is a kind of patriotism, really. Gordon Brown took a completely different tack. He wanted to know, what are British values? Fair play and this kind of thing. And I had to remind him that actually you can't build an identity around values, because values are universal and identities are particular. So he had a lot of problems with that. Both of them had a lot of problems.
But one of the things you've been talking about is that we all have a lot of problems with this. So you refer to the fact that you know, on the gravestone of Jewish immigrants to the UK would be emblazoned, you know, a proud Englishman and a proud Jew, or a proud Jew and a proud Englishman. And you said something which struck me. I can tell you what it is to be a proud Jew, but I can't tell you what it is to be a proud Englishman.
Yeah, unless it's Andy Murray proud Brit, Andy Murray winning at Wimbledon, or the English football team doing quite well, which is, you know, one of those rare phenomena of nature, like total eclipses and things. But, you know, outside the sports arena, it's quite difficult to identify. And I think that's a weakness. England could rely on this inherited identity that was part Shakespeare, part Milton, part school and part sport and all these things. But England developed this kind of, is it Robin Lane Fox or somebody who calls the English habit of one-downmanship, you know, of sort of being embarrassed about the British past, which is colonial and imperialist and so on.
Although the one thing we're not embarrassed about is World War II, which has perhaps inflected some of our relationship with Europe over recent years.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, we were always half-hearted about Europe. And maybe Europe was, to some extent, half-hearted about Europe, because nobody ever even attempted to work out what an European identity might be.
But one component of the European identity, and sorry, this is again something you were talking about earlier, is this idea of rights and the relationship with the state, which is very much based on the Napoleonic code, the sort of French model. And what you were saying is that you feel that this has been a mistake, that the even within Britain, the elite here has bought into this sort of French version of rights and duties and privileges, and has left sort of left that kind of that older English Anglo-American attitude behind it.
One of the things that I mentioned, that the Anglo-American one was based really on religious values and an attempt to create societies in which different kinds of Christians and eventually non-Christians could live together at peace. But other than that, and over and above that, there was this huge body of voluntary associations, the charities, the local neighborhood groups, the Labour Party was built on, you know, friendly societies and trade unions and so on. There was a huge network of those bodies between the individual and the state. And this is what struck Alexis de Tocqueville when he went to America. He said, you know, on the slightest pretext in America, people form committees about things. You name a problem, Americans put together a committee. He called that the art of association. And he rightly said, and again his phrase, that that constituted the apprenticeship of liberty.
Which is why the Putnam findings you presumably found so alarming, which is that people, because of television, when he wrote it, where he said, you know, were effectively splitting apart, that people were not coming together to form
associations. He gave it a name. He called it bowling alone. And he said more Americans than ever are doing tenpin bowling, but fewer than ever are joining tenpin bowling clubs and leagues. So in 1996, he gave this the phrase bowling alone. And technically, he called it a loss of social capital. Now, Britain and America had this huge reservoir of social capital, and he saw that that was really what safeguarded democracy in both countries. Because he noted in both countries, well, he noted especially in America, a phenomenon which he had never encountered before, and he had to invent a new word to cover it. And the word he invented was individualism. Now, if anyone were to look at the contemporary West and say, what's its most striking feature? The answer is individualism. Ours is the most individualistic society in all of history.
But America is the most individualistic. Well, I'm intrigued that you kind of identify it as a communal. I mean, I've done some work on scientific studies, and you know, the value. One of the problems they have with the entire corpus of social psychology is it turns out that what they've been testing are a very weird subsection of humanity, which is college-educated, individualistic Americans who turn out to have nothing in common with the rest of us.
Exactly. They're called weird. Western, industrialized, educated...
rich and democratic.
Rich and democratic, exactly. And Jonathan Haidt is the guy in The Righteous Mind who's pointed out that America are very good on two values, not doing harm to others and fairness, but are almost tone-deaf to three other values, which are respect, loyalty, and reverence. And the end result is that Americans find it quite difficult to understand people who are not American.
But presumably quite a lot of the stuff you're talking about, as you yourself said, comes from faith and comes from the sort of, if not the disappearance of faith, then certainly its exclusion from...
Yeah, what Robert Putnam found, and this was another book of his called American Grace, is that social capital is alive and well in America and mitigates individualism, but it's mainly found in religious congregations. And he says clearly, and he's done the research on this, and he tells me that he's done the same research in Britain with the same findings, is that what makes the difference is actually belonging to a church or a synagogue and going regularly. It doesn't matter what you believe, you can be a total atheist, but if you go to church regularly, you will develop that social capital. You will help people out if they need a job or somebody's homeless or somebody needs a loan. They'll just get involved. And so he finds social capital being kept alive in religious congregations. The real question is, in a very secular public as the coastal elites are in America and as the whole of Britain is almost, can you replicate that without religious congregations? And I don't know. It's an open question.
So I was interested you say that, because when we were talking to Frank Field in part of this this series, he said that he'd been struck by the fact that despite the sort of winnowing in numbers of the Church of England, the Church of England is sort of doing more good proportionately at a, in a constituency level than it ever has before. He's been struck by, you know, he has hordes of momentum activists in his country, which in his country, in his constituency, who vote enormous efforts to getting rid of Frank Field, but would never think of helping out at food banks.
Yeah,
it's in, you know, the sort of the agencies of communal, communal welfare are often centered around the churches.
This was the thing, and actually it was lovely to see them working together across the parties. There was Frank Field in Labour, there was Ian Duncan Smith in the Conservative Party, and there was David Alton for the Lib Dems. And all three of them had this very strong sense of active citizenship, which was based really on houses of worship, Church of England and so on. And they're absolutely right. That remains now one of the great centres. Frank Prochaska is a writer who did actually point out that from the Victorian age onwards, the royal family also played a very big part in lending their patronage to charities. So, for instance, the Prince's Trust and a lot of what Prince
but
Charles
the Christmas that. Appeals in the I think it was the 1900s when yeah. the. Which is, I knew everyone took their lead from the Queen.
Yeah.
And actually the Aberfan disaster, I think, was, again, that was a...
Yeah. So the royals, the Church of England and the royal family are the two great sources of that. And they remain so.
I mean, in terms of your own career, do you find it sort of ironic sometimes that you've sort of been co-opted as a spokesman for all faiths? I mean, despite having been a sort of former chief rabbi, you're sort of, you know, clearly, you know, respected and admired and called upon by people of, you know, from very different traditions.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. In America, they theorize about this, and of course, the most influential political philosopher in the last generation was John Rawls. And John Rawls developed this idea that he called public reason, which had to be a secular language so that it wouldn't exclude anyone. Now, the weird thing is that in Britain, we have something called the BBC. Within the BBC, we have a news program called the Today program. And within the Today program, there's this very unusual thing called Thought for the Day, which is done by Jews, Christians, Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, and all the rest. And when I was asked to do it, and I started long before I was chief rabbi, I suddenly faced this problem. What is it to speak as a Jew to a public 99.5% of whom are not Jewish? I tried to find a precedent for this, and the only one I could find was the prophet Jonah, who was sent to the people of Nineveh, and of course he tried to run away. So it's a very unusual thing. So doing Thought for the Day as a Jew speaking to a non-Jewish audience forced me to develop a language that was very inclusive, not only of people of faith, but of people of no faith whatsoever.
But you're always conscious of the need to speak beyond your own community.
Yeah. Because Britain is, or should be, and I spoke about this during my Wreath lectures in 1990, a community of communities. So there is what I call our second language of identity, I as a Jew, or somebody else as a Hindu, or a Sikh, or something, and the first language of citizenship. So in a diverse society like Britain, you have to be bilingual. There's a language you use for fellow believers, but there's also a language you use to fellow citizens. And you have to develop that language, otherwise you find yourself constructing a kind of mental ghetto.
And so Thought for the Day was your entree into respectable opinion.
It was my apprenticeship in learning to speak a new kind of language. And I think the BBC deserves enormous credit for being, in a, almost an accidental way, one of the main shapers of a diverse yet highly tolerant Britain.
Well, you say diverse yet highly tolerant. I mean, obviously, one of the more alarming developments over the recent years has been that we seem to be becoming a much more intolerant society.
Yeah, that's true.
And especially in terms of anti-Semitism rearing its head again, and within the Labour Party in particular.
Britain today is a less tolerant society than the one, for instance, I went to university in. Let's take something that's much less contentious, atheism. Today's atheists are quite militant. But my doctoral supervisor, the late Sir Bernard Williams, was a profoundly committed atheist who never, ever did anything less than respect my faith. Of course, he challenged it. Be lucid, be coherent, be compelling. But he never rubbished it. So what I learned at university was that university is a place where we give a respectful hearing to views profoundly different from our own. Now, what's happened at universities is political correctness, inverted commas, safe spaces, inverted commas, what's it called, advance?
No platforming?
But what's it called, advance signaling, this phrase, a warning signal or whatever they call it. Anyway, certain voices are excluded on the grounds that they may upset somebody. Now, for me, a safe space is a place where I can listen to people whose views are completely opposed to mine without feeling diminished or threatened. So I think this concept of safe spaces is actually a contradiction in terms.
Allied to that is this idea of cultural appropriation, that you shouldn't be able to speak about the Jewish experience unless you are a Jew. You shouldn't be able to speak about the black experience or write a novel in which a character has a view different from a perspective that's
of
not
course.
Yours.
And obviously, some of the more perceptive things about Jews and Judaism, some of the most perceptive things about Jews and Judaism were said by non-Jews. I mean, of all the books on Judaism that I've learned from, I doubt whether many of them have I learned more than from Paul Johnson's A History of the Jews, which is a book written by a Catholic. Indeed, Thomas Cahill, who is another Catholic historian, wrote a book called The Gifts of the Jews, which I found immensely enlightening. I mean, you have to listen to a multiplicity of voices now, and what a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu has to say about Judaism is something I have to hear, and I may well learn from. I may feel enlarged by.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, do you feel that, because within the Jewish community in the UK, there's an interesting split. There are cosmopolitan Jews, as it were, but then there are also the people who who in the, you know, you, if you go into certain parts of Hampstead, say, you'll see people who have sort of made that decision, the Benedict option, I think the Catholics are now calling it, to kind of to create their own society sort of in parallel with the mainstream. And in fact, if you go to Israel, it's an even more pronounced phenomenon.
Sure. And, you know, it was an extraordinary thing for me personally. This Rod Dreher has written this book called The Benedict Option, by which he is referring to the closing two pages of one of the great books of our time, Alasdair MacIntyre's After Virtue. And Alasdair MacIntyre, as a ex-Marxist, now I think Catholic, made the case, well, he said, it's not that the barbarians are at the gates, it's that the barbarians have been ruling us for some time. And his argument in that book, published in 1981, was that, you know, we have to turn inward, like St. Benedict did, create monasteries, create secluded, enclosed, inward-looking communities.
Safe spaces.
Safe spaces, indeed. Now, I remember, you know, I used to discuss this kind of thing with various prime ministers, and I remember sitting with Tony Blair in around 2004 and looking at how the Jewish community had got a lot stronger, because we have now a lot more Jewish day schools than we used to have. And I said, you know, Prime Minister, this is wonderful news for us. We're much stronger than we were a generation ago, but I see a danger, and that danger is we're turning inward. And I see all of the faith communities turning inward right now. And I suppose Brexit was a national moment of turning inward. And I said, I was bothered about that. And I actually took it on board, and I wrote a book called To Heal the Fractured World, where I deliberately set out to turn our Jewish community outward and say, yes, the fact that you go to a Jewish day school means that you will know a lot more about your Jewish heritage, but I want you to take that heritage and turn you into active citizens who are engaged with the welfare of people beyond the boundaries of community. So I saw that quite a long while ago, and I saw it as a danger, and I did what I think I could do as a religious leader of the Jewish community, and the community did respond to that. So I think, and of course the C of E has always turned outward. I think you're seeing this inward turn today amongst Catholics in America. And they are saying, and it's Rod Dreher is only one. I mean, there are two others who've, Charles Chaput has written at the same time, a book called Stranger in a Strange Land, and expressing that same feeling that America is no longer a country whose ethos I, as a Catholic, can identify with. So I think Catholicism now also needs people who turn it outward, because this inward turn is not good for national cohesiveness and social solidarity.
In a way, it actually refers back to what you were talking about people not buying into the national story. Just,
yeah.
We're used to thinking of that in terms of, you know, the sort of deaths of despair, people who are left out of the economy. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is that there's also an element of people who feel that they're left out of the sort of, who feel alienated by the prevailing social and moral values of
Islam. Mm. And that you see that most clearly among Muslims. But don't let us think it's only a problem about Islam. I think we forget that back in 1899, a French sociologist, completely secular guy, but his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all rabbis. His name was Emil Durkheim. Durkheim wrote a book called Suicide, in which he made the radical claim that any society suffering anomie, that is, a lack of agreed moral values, you will see the suicide rate go up. Now, I don't think Emil Durkheim could have foreseen suicide taking the form of suicide bombers, but it follows from his theory. So if you lack an agreed moral code within a society, you're going to get all sorts of fringe phenomena that are not going to be good news. And he saw that a long time ago.
So what would your prescription be for fixing this? If you were appointed by the new Prime Minister as Secretary of State for healing a divided nation?
I would certainly. The first thing I would do is re-empower local communities. I would say, just, I'll tell you bluntly what I did propose, and we never got there for various reasons. I said to Rowan Williams after, we could see all sorts of ethnic and religious tensions in Birmingham and Bradford and other Midlands towns beginning with B. I said, Rowan, why don't we, you and I and Vincent Nichols and a Muslim and a Sikh and a Hindu, go out on the streets of Birmingham and go and actually visit community groups that are bringing people together. I said, we know that in a media-driven world, the hardest thing to do is to make the good news news. But I think if the chief rabbi and the Archbishop of Canterbury and an imam and a head of the Catholic Church were to go out into the streets of Bradford and Birmingham and things, we could actually make a difference. We could highlight local community activists who are doing this. And I really would decentralize. I mean, that was the strength of America. I remember sitting once with the senior group I have ever sat with at a moment when there was a feeling in the early 90s that the whole establishment was collapsing. And about eight of us sat together with the agenda, how do we save the establishment? And one of them was the American ambassador at the time, a very bright man called Ray Seitz, who looked at us. We were sitting in St. James's in a restaurant, and he said, do you realize that every single important person in Britain is at this moment having lunch within 1 mile of where we sit? He said, that could never happen in America. So I would decentralize. I would empower the neighborhoods. I would get the local religious groups to lead in conjunction with the charity groups and the citizenship associations, and empower the localities.
But isn't there I agree with, in fact, one of my first jobs in politics was as working for a thing called Direct Democracy, which was about trying to decentralize power. But isn't there a sense that you're sort of swimming against the tide, that the story of the last 30 years in the West has been this incredible successful attempt to sort of rid ourselves of anything which holds us back from fulfilling our immediate impulses, and technology has obviously played quite a key role in this, and the reason that we don't get involved in our communities is just because we feel we don't have enough time. We feel kind of rushed off our feet, that there aren't enough hours in the day.
I'll tell you what I see. I see a synagogue in Golders Green, of which I used to be the rabbi many decades ago. I see it's done something, and it was dying on its feet. It was. I once said when I came here, the average age was 78, and after only 4 years, the average age is now 82. So, it was an old age sort of community. Eventually, how many years ago? 3 or 4 years ago, I think. 4 years ago, they took the outbuildings, they knocked them down, and made a primary school. And now I see the 5-year-old kids bringing their parents to the synagogue. I'm not saying they all spend their time deep in prayer. They spend most of their time looking after their kids in the children's service. But they are now members of a community. Now, one thing that the social networking software does is it immensely thickens the bonds of community. The first thing you'll do is ask on the synagogue mailing list, does anyone know a good plumber? Or does anyone have to spare some garden furniture or something or other? So that technology can diffuse community, or it can strengthen community.
So in fact, the counter to Putnam, which I didn't mention earlier, is that if you actually look at membership of individual groups, it seems to be going up because email allows people to strengthen bonds formed offline.
Yeah. And one thing that's really fascinating, and this is coming from, believe it or not, the Bay Area in San Francisco and other Silicon Valley type places, is that they are finally waking up to the fact that the late Steve Jobs refused to let his kids have an iPad. What they are discovering is that smartphones are destroying their kids' capacity for sustained attention, They are robbing them of social skills. They can't even make decent eye contact. At family meals, they're sitting with their smartphones under the table texting their friends. And what they're doing, one family after another, is saying, we are going to have a screen-free day. They have reinvented the Sabbath, because one thing we can't do as Jews is use electronic devices on the Sabbath. Despite the Kindle and everything like it, we will remain one day a week the people of the book. So we are finding that to strengthen families, people are bringing back religious institutions that they got rid of maybe 20 or 50 years ago. Their kids are now going to Jewish schools and bringing the parents to synagogue, and they are devoting at least that one day a week to family and community. And I am seeing this revive all over the place, and even the really driven two-income families, and believe me, you know, our kids are that kind of driven two-income families, high aspirers, they are making sure that they dedicate sacred time, I mean dedicated time, to family and to community and to things like prayer, to things like gratitude.
But even in secular families, one of the sort of interesting parallels with the traditions is the family meal, the sort of, you know, breaking the fast together. That's one of the things which knits families together.
Totally, and that, of course, that used to be a part of what made Britain Britain until the government deregulated Sunday, which oddly enough, sadly, took place when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. I'm sure she didn't particularly want it. But families used to get together every Sunday and have a family meal. Today, 30 to 40% of families in Britain don't own a dining table.
But they do own a television.
So they own a television, and they, you know, come in one after the other, take something out of the freezer, stick it in the microwave, and the social affairs unit, Digby Anderson, used to call that cereal grazing. So I think we're seeing the family meal come back as a way of seeing the family come back.
So we're at this conference, which is on the sort of security of the West, and obviously talking about sort of external threats. I mean, do you feel that the sort of the threats to the West are primarily internal or primarily external?
Yes, 100%. I wrote a book, published a book in 1997, called The Politics of Hope. 40 years earlier, in 1957, Isaiah Berlin had given his famous inaugural lecture as Chicherley Professor of Political Thought at Oxford, called Two Concepts of Liberty. And in that lecture, he had seen as the greatest threat to freedom the totalitarianism of the Soviet Union. And my case was that in 40 years, this is 97 now, you know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, the biggest threat was not totalitarianism, it was the moral vacuum at the heart of those Western democracies, because freedom is, I believe, a moral achievement. I sent the book to Isaiah Berlin. He said he was good. I asked him to read it, and he agreed. And unfortunately, I didn't hear from him for several months. So I phoned him up at Headington Hall, which was his home. And his wife, Aline, Lady Aline, answered the phone and said, "Ah, Chief Rabbi, Isaiah has just been talking about you." Now, Isaiah was a secular Jew, did not spend his time talking about rabbis. So I said, "In what context?" And she said, "He's just asked whether you would officiate at his funeral." And I did my various utterances to avert the evil eye and told her not to think of such things. But clearly he knew, and 4 days later he died, and I did officiate at his funeral in Oxford. So I never heard what Isaiah thought about the politics of hope. But I stick by that proposition. I think it was the most passionate statement I could make for civil society.
And even now with China, Islam, Russia, cyber threats, or all of the sort of swamp of chaos around us, you still feel that it's...
Of course, yeah. Of course. I mean, Sam Huntington makes the case in the last chapter of his book, The Clash of Civilizations. Of course, when you write a book like that, The one thing you never do is read the last chapter, but do read the last chapter, because in the last chapter, he says the West should not seek to impose its values on the world. It should be content with seeking to impose its own values on itself. And I hold that. The West is losing those values. And if you lack belief in yourself, then you can't function as a player on the international arena. And the world will then go to Russia or China or India or Islam. And okay, we have a multipolar world. That's interesting. And it seems to me that China and India and these great civilizations, which are, you know, rising again from the dust, I mean, these are great civilizations. India is a civilization at least as old as the Abrahamic monotheisms. China is an extraordinary civilization that led the world technologically until around the 16th or 17th century. They invented printing long before we did. They were ahead of us on all sorts of things, paper, gunpowder, china, porcelain and all the rest of it. They were a great civilization. They've been only in eclipse for two centuries. There's no doubt that China is a civilizational force to be reckoned with, and we should be, you know, I once sat at a meeting where the speakers were Larry Summers, who was Treasury Secretary as well as President of Harvard, and Jim Wolfensohn, head of the World Bank, and Stanley Fisher, head of the Bank of Israel. And they were discussing what would you encourage your children to do? And I think Larry Summers said, you know, keep your faith in the dollar. And Jim Wolfensohn said, teach them Mandarin. And I think he was right. China is a great civilization. We needn't feel threatened by it. All we need feel threatened by is our own lack of faith in ourselves.
But presumably as well, our own reaction to the threats facing us. So that if the recent events in Manchester and London leads to a sort of a crackdown, a security crackdown, and to exactly to entrenching the kind of divisions you were talking about earlier, that would.
Look, Britain can come through this. You know, I've just come back from Peru. And in Peru, there was a reign of terror.
The Shining Path.
Yeah. In which the death penalty was between 70 and 80,000. I mean, it makes British terror, sets it in perspective. I'm not sure how many people lost their lives in the IRA bombing campaigns in the 70s. So Britain knows how to handle these things without feeling existentially threatened. And I think resilience here is the key word.
So looking to the future, I mean, do you still have the audacity of hope, to paraphrase Obama, who obviously stole your idea? Or, I mean, are you pessimistic or optimistic about...
Well, look, I always make a distinction. Forgive my team for having heard this before, but there is a significant difference between optimism and hope. Optimism is the belief that things will get better. Hope is the belief that if we work hard enough together, we can make them better. It needs no courage to be an optimist, only a certain kind of naivety, but it sometimes needs a great deal of courage to have hope. No Jew who knows our people's history can be an optimist, but no Jew worthy of the name ever gave up hope. So, of course, I still believe in the politics of hope, and the alternative, which is the politics of fear, a very, very bad politics. To renew hope in Britain, we have to renew our families, we have to renew our communities, we have to renew our localities, and we have to renew our sense of identity. As a beautifully diverse nation, a community of communities that are joined together for the common good, in a culture that is part Christian, part secular, but nonetheless knows how to make generous space for people of other faiths and none.
Lord Sachs, thank you very much. And if you like this, please subscribe.
Hold up.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.